Is the law the opposite of the gospel? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled, Is the Law Bad? Some Myths About God's Law. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read about Tim Wood's journey from many different Christian confessions to the sound and seamless theology of the Lutheran Confession, the free online Issues Etc. journal.
I'm introducing a bill to bring marriage equality to the state of New York. This is a civil rights issue.
You know what? I think that I believe that a marriage should be between a man and a woman. No offense to anybody out there, but that's how I was raised, and that's how I think that it should be between a man and a woman. Thank you.
Gee, well, why don't we blame Winston Churchill and FDR for focusing too narrowly on defeating the Nazis to the neglect of other issues?
Mormon bosoms burn at a higher centigrade than non-Mormon bosoms.
Southern Illinois truck drivers, the love issues, etc.
It's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking that the defense of the unborn is a particularly Christian thing. There are a lot of Christian pro-lifers out there, that's true, but we do not have a monopoly on the defense of the unborn as Christians or as pro-lifers. We're going to be talking a little bit about what our guest in this hour, as we conclude our series with him on equipping pro-life Christians, calls co-belligerents, that is, allies that we may have, not theologically or even on other issues, but on the defense of the unborn. We'll start out talking about that with Scott Klusendorf here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. this Monday afternoon, the 20th of April. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Our call-in number for the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-6943, 1-877-623-MYIE. Our in-studio email address for your questions and comments as well, talkback@issuesetc.org. We'll talk with Pastor Dennis Marsoff of Bethany Lutheran College about a person remembered in the Reformation wing of the church this day, Johannes Bugenhagen. He was, in some senses, pastor to the great reformer himself, Martin Luther. They did have their differences. We'll talk a little bit about some of those. Dr. Gene Rudd of the Christian Medical Association will join us to talk about in vitro fertilization. That's in the news lately, and people are wondering about, you know, with people having, one woman having 8 children at once and others having multiple births, there are better ways for in vitro fertilization to proceed. And of course, we just heard from the National Institutes of Health last week that those in vitro fertilization embryos that are so-called left over from would be used for embryonic stem cell research. We'll do some open lines there in the second hour of the program, audio open lines, an ABC News story about the GOP and gay marriage. Many within are saying we simply have to get with the program for gay marriage. And then Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris will join us. We'll talk with her about two issues. Remarks made by Miss California. If you were watching the pageant, she was asked a tough question about gay marriage in Vermont. And she said she believes that marriage should be between a man and a woman. We'll also talk with Jennifer about the recent Ellen Goodman column on same-sex marriage. Ellen Goodman says, it's inevitable. Get used to it. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE, or talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute and author of the new book, The Case for Life. Scott, welcome back.
Todd, good to be back.
I'd like your reaction to late last week, the announcement from the National Institutes for Health on the federal funding limits for embryonic stem cell research.
Well, it's good news, bad news. Let me put it this way. It could have been a lot worse. For example, at least on paper at the moment, there seems to be a clear demarcation between using funds for leftover embryos and using funds to specifically create human embryos for no other purpose other than destroying them for medical research. Look, I do not, of course, support using funding for using, quote, leftover embryos. What a degrading term they've come up with. But using, quote, spare embryos for medical research. That's wrong. You can't kill one human being to benefit another human being, and it doesn't make any difference whether someone else wants them or not. So that's bad news, and it's certainly a step backwards. But I was fully anticipating that we were going to get full-blown cloning put on us, funded through the NIH, and that would have been very bad news indeed.
Okay, can you explain to me on this issue the difference between what was announced last week by the NIH and what President Bush, what his policy was for virtually all 8 years of his term as president, and what President Obama promised he would give by way of federal funding for embryonic stem cell research?
President Bush inherited both a funding policy and a no funding policy when he took office in 2001. Congress had passed in 1996 an amendment known as the Dickey Amendment. The Dickey Amendment says federal funds may not be used to create and destroy human embryos for medical research. The Clinton administration sought to get around this amendment toward the end of Clinton's second term. And what the Clinton administration argued was that federal funds would not be used to destroy the embryos. The funds would only be used to do the work on the stem cells derived from those destroyed embryos, which, of course, was a ridiculous way to put it. Imagine if we had a group out there that was destroying dolphins and saying, look, we're not going to use federal funds to kill the dolphins. We'll just use federal funds to experiment and do medical testing on them after they're destroyed. Well, animal rights groups would be outraged. Well, President Bush takes office in 2001, and he has a choice. Does he go ahead and work with the Dickey Amendment as passed by Congress, or does he go with the Clinton policy that his predecessor had started to put in place? And what Bush did is he said, look, we will allow funding on those cell lines currently in place that came from embryos that were killed prior to August of 2001, but there would be no additional funds whatsoever allowed at the federal level for destroying any more embryos and then using funds to do research on the cells derived from those embryos. So what Bush did is put a stop to any future use of embryos being used for research with taxpayer dollars. So that's the policy that stayed in place up until the time Barack Obama took office. Now, of course, Barack Obama has reversed that, and he gave authority to the National Institutes for Health to come up with its own funding guidelines, provided they allow federal funds to be used for embryonic stem cell research.
Did President Obama promise more than the NIH has announced?
I think so. And so I was a little surprised that there wasn't more that came out of the NIH. But I will warn our listeners, I don't think that the door has been shut on cloning funding by any means. It's just at the moment it's not including that. Whether that could change down the road, hard to say. But I certainly expected worse news. It's certainly not good news, but it could have been worse. It's kind of like being told by your physician, you've got diabetes, but you don't have cancer.
Okay, talking about the general defense of the unborn, often Christian pro-lifers will simply assume that Christian pro-lifers kind of have a monopoly on the defense of the unborn. But you write in your book, The Case for Life, about co-belligerence that Christian pro-lifers have, perhaps only on the narrow issue of defending the unborn. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about that Christians committed to the foundational theological doctrines of the Protestant Reformation must maintain integrity to those principles. We must never sacrifice them or compromise them to work with others. But provided we're not being called upon to do that, there's nothing wrong with working with unbelievers to promote social justice in the culture. You look at the civil rights movement of the 1960s and 70s, people from all different denominations join hands to work together, not to save souls eternally, but to promote justice for the weak and vulnerable here on earth. There's nothing wrong with Christians being involved in that, provided they are true to their doctrinal distinctives.
Is the pastor sometimes the weakest link in the chain that we would call the Christian pro-life movement?
Sometimes, Todd, and I would say actually, if you talk to pro-life advocates out there, the considered wisdom on this is that pastors are a problem. I like to take a little more optimistic view, and I do that in the book, rather than saying to the pastor, you're the problem, you're not doing enough, blood is on your hands because you're not speaking out on this issue. I go ahead and assume, for the sake of the book, that most pastors do care about the issue, but they're A, not willing to pay the price that they will have to pay for taking it on, or B, they're not quite sure how to do it and do it biblically and do it right so that they are compassionate and yet truthful. And for that second group that does care and does want to do this but isn't quite sure how, I give four steps that I think they need to take to be an effective pro-life pastor.
All right, we'll talk a little bit about that on the other side of the break. We're concluding our series this week with Scott Klusendorf of the Life Training Institute on equipping pro-life Christians. Our call-in number this Monday afternoon, the 20th of April, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943, or email your questions or comments to us right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. We'll also come back to the issue of co-belligerence, too, because there are lots of people out there who are interested for their own reasons in defending the unborn. And if we have allies, if Christian pro-lifers have allies in the community in this country that can help turn things around, we need to make the best use of that relationship with those allies, again, as Scott Klusendorf so rightly pointed out, without compromising one syllable, one molecule of our doctrine and our practice. And it can be done. We're talking about defending the unborn. Scott Klusendorf is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc.
Or a little tough boy with beautiful brown eyes. I paid for the murder before they determine the sex. Choosing our life over your life meant your death. And you never got a chance to even open your eyes. Sometimes I wonder as a fetus if you fought for your life. Would you have been a little genius in love with math? Would you have played in your school clothes and made me mad? Would you have been a little...
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, talking with Scott Klusendorf, concluding our four-part series with him on equipping pro-life Christians. He's author of the new book, The Case for Life. We're giving away a copy of that book to best caller or emailer, questions or comments, talkback@issuesetc.org or 1-877-623-6943. The number again, 1-877-623-MYIE or talkback@issuesetc.org. Scott, before the break, you said that there are four suggestions you have for the Christian pastor as part of the link in the chain of the pro-life movement. Give us those four points briefly.
Well, in addition to understanding the times that we live in and being able to cogently address those things intellectually, I think pastors have four key tasks. Number one, they have got to give their parishioners and the people in their congregations a biblical view of human value. We should not presume that they understand that. So, for example, the pastor is going to want to teach, number one, that all humans bear God's image, and thus, number two, they should not be killed without justification. In other words, the shedding of innocent blood is wrong. The other thing pastors need to do is not only preach a biblical view of human value, but equip their people to defend it in the public square. Every church youth group member should know how to give a scientific and philosophic case for the pro-life view, like the one I outlined in The Case for Life. The other thing that people need to know how to do is answer the tough questions. How do you deal with people who throw up roadblocks to your pro-life convictions? The third thing pastors have got to do is preach a cross-centered gospel to men and women wounded by abortion. It is simply not the case that in neglecting to preach on abortion, we will spare women and men guilt. I've once had a pastor say to me, I don't want to talk about abortion. I want to spare people in my church a guilt trip. And I pointed out to him, you're not sparing them a guilt trip. You're sparing them healing because of their unconfessed sin that's keeping them out of fellowship with Christ. The fourth thing a pastor has got to do is he's got to confront his fears. And typically, clergy are afraid of what will happen when they preach on the abortion issue. And the key question for every spiritual leader listening is this: do I trust God to protect His ministry through me when I preach inconvenient truth? If the answer to that question is no, then obviously these tough topics are going to be left undiscussed. If the answer is yes, the pastor is going to move forward, convinced that God's truth is God's truth, and it's going to be proclaimed, and the chips will fall where they may. However, I will say that when pastors graciously and yet incisively teach on issues like abortion, rather than it being a downer for the church, it ends up being a very much a winning issue. People get healed. People are impressed that the pastor dealt with it delicately yet truthfully, and non-believers are impressed that the Christian worldview has something intelligent to say to an important issue of our day. So far from driving people away, it actually works well in the church's favor.
I want to pick up on your third point about dealing with people post-abortion. You talked about the proclamation of a cross-centered gospel for people who are living with the tremendous regret and guilt associated with their involvement in abortion. And some people might say, well, I go to a Christian congregation. There certainly are no men or women with that problem sitting next to me on Sunday morning. How would you respond?
Yeah, they'd be very wrong. There's been over 85 million Americans involved in abortion-related decisions, and I'm talking there not just about the women who had abortions, but the boyfriends and husbands who encouraged them to, the parents who encouraged them to. These people are in our churches, and they desperately need to be brought out of denial and into confessing their sins so that they can find the healing that comes through the gospel of Jesus Christ. And these people that are in our churches, yes, it's true, they don't want to look at this issue, at least some of them. But when we ignore it, we leave them trapped in the bondage of their own sins. And this is where the gospel is so incredible, because the gospel takes into account, as you know, Todd, the terrible news of our condition before God the Father, a righteous God who created us in His image to worship and enjoy Him, and our race, through the federal head of Adam, rebelled against Him and refused to submit to Him. And God, who had the right to destroy us for our rebellion, instead sent Jesus, the righteous one, as our substitute. And God poured out His wrath against sin on that substitute so you and I could be forgiven, and not only forgiven, but adopted and dearly loved members of His family. That's incredible news for people who've been wounded by abortion. But you can't get to the good news if you ignore the bad news.
Now, we took a little time at the beginning of our conversation this time to deal with the more timely issue. Can you give us a few minutes on the other side of the break so we can conclude, you know, get all our bows tied up nicely? Scott?
Yes.
Can you give us a few minutes on the other side of the break?
I sure can.
All right, we're not there yet, but I just want to make sure you could. Let's talk about that co-belligerence again. I think there's a lot of hesitation, especially when a Christian pro-lifer, not dealing with a Roman Catholic, or we're talking about evangelical pro-lifers, not dealing with the Roman Catholic or some other denomination, but perhaps unbelievers who are not Christians at all, but still can see the light of day on the issue of the unborn and the need for the defense there. What's your best advice in making the most of that relationship without theological compromise?
Oh, listen, I will work, Todd, with anybody who wants to promote the defense of human life, provided, of course, I'm not required to compromise any of my theological truths that I hold to. I work with atheists. I've got a friend who's an atheist. This guy and I go round and round on the existence of God, and I point out to him where he's mistaken. But when it comes to the pro-life issue, he's right there with me, and he'll write me and say, hey, I need advice dealing with this guy who's bringing up these issues, and I don't know what to say. Help me out, and I'll help him out. I'm perfectly willing to go fly somewhere and do a seminar for a group of atheists and teach them how to defend the pro-life view. And I don't believe I'm compromising one bit. You know, Todd, if one of our critics, and you and I both know, we won't name any names, but there's been people who have been critical of co-belligerence, of working with others who don't hold our theological views. If one of those critics of our willingness to work with non-believers had a situation where his own son or daughter fell into a pool and was drowning, and a paramedic showed up to save his own child, not for a moment would that paramedic be quizzed over his theological positions. But yet when it comes to saving someone else's child, all of a sudden we're going to impose this test that says you've got to pass it or we won't work with you to save innocent human lives. I find that just astoundingly crazy to consider.
You know, I think about Hadley Arkus, who wrote the Born Again Infants Protection Act. He's, as far as I know, a Jewish man teaching at Amherst College, and yet one of the best minds, especially legally, when it comes to thinking through the legal issues surrounding the defense of the unborn. Your thoughts there with just a minute or two before we take our break.
You're absolutely right, Todd. Hadley Arkus is brilliant, and his book, Natural Rights and the Right to Choose, should be required reading for all of your listeners. And indeed, in my own book, I relied on his thinking in portions. You've also got people who may not be with us on the Protestant Reformation issue, people like Robert P. George or Patrick Lee at the Franciscan University at Steubenville, great minds who have contributed the intellectual heavy lifting that we need to make our case credible in the public square, and you bet I'm going to work with those people.
Do Christians sometimes have a blind spot because we tend to approach the life issue from a biblical basis, that there are people who can come to the right conclusions, perhaps borrowing unwittingly upon that basis, but perhaps unwittingly nonetheless?
Great question, Todd. Unbelievers may have trouble grounding their moral claims on abortion. In other words, they may have difficulty saying why objective morals are a requirement for us, but that doesn't mean they can't recognize them. And I think that's a biblical way to look at it. I think the Apostle Paul even argues that non-believers can recognize certain moral truths. They're written in our nature as human beings, and they cry out for our recognition. Although the unbeliever, in this case an atheist, like my friend I mentioned a moment ago, may have difficulty explaining why these objective morals exist, he nonetheless is perfectly willing to accept them, even if he can't totally explain the grounding for them. So as long as they can recognize the moral truths, there's no reason we can't work with them to promote justice.
Scott's going to be with us for a few minutes on the other side of this break. We need to talk about the impact that the pro-life movement has had and can have in the future, especially during a rather discouraging chapter in the pro-life movement. We had some significant, although incremental, legislative and court gains in the last decade. More regulation and more done to slowly but surely undermine the legal framework behind Roe v. Wade and all of the other cases that brought us abortion on demand and made it so difficult to defend the unborn. And people think, well, now with the pro-choice president and pro-choice Congress, what are we going to do? Can we make any more progress? Do we have to take 4 or 8 years off? We're going to be talking about the extraordinary work being done by pro-lifers. And we're giving away Scott Klusendorf's book, The Case for Life. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MY-I-E. You can email your questions or comments to us right here in the studio as well. It's Monday afternoon, the 20th of April. Our email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. talkback@issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkins. Stay tuned. More with Scott Klusendorf right after this. You can call it what you like.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're concluding our four-part series with Scott Klusendorf, equipping pro-life Christians. He's president of Life Training Institute, author of the new book, The Case for Life. You can purchase The Case for Life by using Amazon.com. There's a link under the on-demand page of our website. Just go there tonight, issuesetc.org, and look for the link. When you purchase using this link, a portion of your purchase will help support Issues, etc. issuesetc.org. Click on demand. You'll find that link. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 1-877-623-MYIE, or talk back at issuesetc.org. This email from Bob in Newport, Vermont. Francis Schaeffer used this term. He makes the point that we have to be co-belligerents without being allies. Thank you very much for your email, Bob. Your thoughts there, Scott?
I think that's a fair way to look at it. The way I would rephrase that is to say we can do co-belligerence, but we don't do co-confession. We don't pretend that all religious truth claims are the same, that all religions are the same, and we just minimize our differences and kind of get along. No, we are clear that we come from differing perspectives. I just spent the weekend in the Washington, D.C. area training about 50 Catholic people how to defend the pro-life view, and I also spoke at Georgetown Law School to a group of students there, many of whom were Catholic. And by the way, when I was at Georgetown, I didn't demand that all the religious imagery be covered up. But while I was there, I never once compromised on the gospel. I simply gave a pro-life training seminar, and nobody asked me to compromise. But I didn't then say, hey, let's all go to Mass together and worship.
All right. I think that clears it up. Let's talk about the future here, because we've had some real, although incremental, legal and judicial steps forward taken with regard to defending the unborn in the last decade or so. Really for the first time since Roe v. Wade was passed in 1973. And yet now we have a pro-choice leadership in our country, and many pro-lifers are saying we're just not going to be able to get anything done. How do you respond?
Well, there's no doubt that the entire federal government is now firmly committed to the proposition that an entire class of human beings can be set aside to be killed simply because they're in the way of something we want. And that is discouraging news. But Todd, surrender is not an option. And I'm telling people that everywhere. People who fight for human justice nearly always face incredibly dark times. Churchill did, Lincoln did, Wilberforce did. It's not uncommon. They face unbelievable challenges that require incredible fortitude to get over. So while we're waiting for a more favorable political environment, there are things we can be doing. For example, our local crisis pregnancy centers need our support. Number two, every pro-lifer needs to equip themselves to engage. They need the logic of the morals that involve the pro-life view. They need to understand that moral logic and communicate it effectively. And not only that, Todd, they've also got to have a clear understanding on what the political movement really is about. I find that a lot of pro-life Christians really haven't looked at the politics of this. They don't understand how you move legislation. They don't understand how you rally voters. In fact, there's almost been this view that, oh, we've been too politically involved. Well, I don't buy that for a moment. When people tell me that evangelicals are too involved in politics, I say prove it, because I think it's just the opposite. We're not involved enough. The other thing I would say is that we need to make sure that we're recruiting more full-time pro-life workers. The other side has lots of money and lots of people working for its benefit. My colleague Greg Cunningham puts it real well. He says there are more people working full-time to kill babies than there are working full-time to save them, and that's because killing babies is very profitable while saving them is very costly. So costly, Greg says, that vast numbers of people who claim to be against abortion do just enough to salve the conscience, but not enough to actually stop the killing. And boy, that's a stunning indictment of where we are as a movement, but it's a true one. We're going to have to take seriously recruiting more full-time people to make a defense for the pro-life view in the public square.
All right, finally, you talk at the end of your book, and this is an odd subject for radio being a purely oral medium, but you say the pro-life movement needs to think about going visual. What do you mean?
We need to be willing to show graphic depictions of abortion. We need to do this lovingly, and we need to do it with care, but it needs to be done. Pro-lifers in the past have made one of two errors with visuals. They've either used them poorly or they don't use them at all. There's a third way, use them wisely. And I'm happy to tell you that there are groups doing this now very effectively. Groups like Justice for All, for example, are going on college campuses, and they are putting up displays. These are expensive displays that are professionally airbrushed pictures depicting abortion. And college students are flocking to these displays, and they're engaging in conversation with pro-life students who've been trained to defend the pro-life view. And these students that come to the pro-life display are not only seeing the pictures, they're hearing a defense for our view. It does two things. It changes how people feel about abortion. That's what the pictures do. Then the arguments offered by the pro-lifers change how they think. That's a great 1-2 combination. And you know, Todd, there's historical precedent for this. In 1955, you may remember, not that you were alive then, but you may remember hearing about the story of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old African-American boy who went to Chicago or came from Chicago to visit his cousin in the town of Money, Mississippi. And when he got off the train, he bragged to his cousins about the two white girlfriends back in Chicago. The cousins didn't buy it for a minute, and they said, look, we don't even speak to white people here, let alone date them. You don't have two white girlfriends back in Chicago. He said, I do. And they dared him to talk to a white woman down there. Well, that afternoon when they went into Bryant's grocery store, a little tiny store in downtown Money, Mississippi, Emmett did just that. He flirtatiously said to a married woman as he purchased a piece of gum from her, hey, babe, thanks. Innocent, but flirtatious. As he was leaving, the cousin said, oh, you're going to get it now. And boy, were they right, because two nights later, the woman's husband and another man took Emmett at gunpoint from his uncle's home where he was staying. They drove him outside Money, Mississippi, savagely beat him for several hours, and then finally killed him. And when the sheriff discovered that boy's body, he could not believe what he was looking at. He sealed it in a coffin, sent it to his mother in Chicago. And when Mamie Till got that body, Todd, she had the press there, and they said to her, what are you going to do? She said, we're having a funeral for my boy, and it's going to be an open casket funeral. And that picture of Emmett Till in that casket went national in Jet magazine, and it launched the civil rights movement in this country, because 3 months later, Rosa Parks refused to go to the back of the bus when she was ordered to do so, and she said that image of Emmett Till gave her the courage. Why do I say go visual? Because I'm convinced if we don't lovingly but truthfully open the casket on abortion, this nation will continue to tolerate an injustice it never has to look at.
Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute, author of the new book, The Case for Life. Bob from Vermont, send us an email with your mailing address, and we'll send you Scott Klusendorf's book, The Case for Life. Folks, you can defend life from beginning to end by making a tax-deductible gift to Issues, etc. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also make a gift by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. The address again, LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Scott, thank you very much for being our guest.
Todd, thank you. I really appreciate you guys featuring the book.